Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of ENT in a Nutshell. My name is Patrick Kiesling, and I'll be your host. Today, we are joined by Dr. Kira Meister, a board-certified and fellowship-trained pediatric otolaryngologist. Today, we will be discussing congenital midline nasal masses. Previous episodes have already covered JNA and hemangiomas, which definitely can fall near or under this category, so I encourage you to listen to those episodes as well. Today, we'll focus on nasal dermoids, nasal gliomas, and encephaloceles specifically. Dr. Meister, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, so let's get started. Today's topics cover important pathologies within the field of pediatric otolaryngology and are important for us to understand individually as well as how we can distinguish them from each other. In our recent choanal atresia and nasal piriform aperture stenosis episode, we reviewed nasal embryology and development, which I think also helps contextualize today's topics of congenital midline nasal masses. So for the listeners, if you haven't already listened to that episode, I'd recommend pausing here, listening to that, and then coming back to this episode for our discussion today. So first, let's start with midline congenital nasal masses or lesions in general. When we see a pediatric patient with a midline nasal lesion, what should we be thinking about in terms of the differential diagnosis?
Sure. So midline congenital nasal lesions in general are pretty rare, occurring in about 1 in 20,000 to 40,000 births. Nasal dermoids are actually the most common midline congenital nasal lesion. Other possibilities include nasal gliomas and encephaloceles, which we'll also be discussing today. We also want to consider other possibilities as well, including hemangiomas. Important to consider since about 60% of these do occur in the head and neck. Juvenile nasopharyngeal angiofibroma. These have a characteristic presentation in that they are nearly exclusively seen in our adolescent males, presenting with epistaxis, a nasal mass, and symptoms of nasal obstruction. More rarely, we can see epidermoid cyst, teratomas, neurofibromas, lipomas, and lymphangiomas. Basically, anything that could come from the lining of the nose, we can see as well. Patients will present with a wide variety of symptoms depending on the lesion and where it's manifesting. Congenital nasal masses obstruct the nasal airway in infants, and they could result in respiratory distress due to the nasal breathing tendencies of newborns and infants. Symptoms worsen with feeding and then improve with crying if their obstruction is severe enough. So very similar to our other congenital nasal obstruction pathologies that are in the other episodes, such as piriform aperture stenosis or choanal atresia. Congenital nasal lesions can sometimes be noticed based on the appearance of the external nose with drainage or recurrent infections. In older kids, nasal masses may present with obstruction, epistaxis, or recurrent sinus infections. Again, depending really on where the lesion is and how big it is. So as you can tell, there are a lot of different options for what could be going on in a child with a congenital nasal lesion. Your evaluation will help you decide which of these options may be more likely and help determine the next steps in your workup. We'll get into more detail with these specific diagnoses today, what makes them unique, and how we manage each of them.
Great. So let's start with nasal dermoids. What exactly is a nasal dermoid and how does it develop?
Sure. So nasal dermoids are just like dermoids in other parts of the body in that they are epithelium-lined lesions. So from a pathology standpoint, that means that they are lined with stratified squamous epithelium of ectodermal origin. So important key word there. They can also have the dermal appendages, and we consider those mesodermal origin. So they're described as a well-defined cyst lined by the squamous epithelium, again, ectodermal origin, with those adnexal structures. So we're thinking hair follicles, sebaceous glands, sweat glands, and those are mesodermal origin. Importantly, they don't have an endodermal origin. So their lack of having an endodermal component is how they're differentiated from teratomas in the lab. In real life, they can be very similar in how they behave. These are benign lesions, but they will continue to grow. And so they can be locally destructive, although there's no associated risk of malignant transformation. Because nasal dermoids arise from congenital fusion abnormalities at the nasal root, it's thought that they occur as a result of incomplete resorption of neuroectodermal tissue during the development of specifically the frontonasal process, which is a specific area that exists during embryonic development. There are really two theories for about how this happens. The first one is the superficial inclusion theory. This means that nasal dermoids are formed by the submucosal trapping of those ectodermal elements during the fusion of the lateral nasal processes. The other theory is the cranial origin theory, and this implies that nasal dermoids result from the faulty recession of the dura from the prenasal space during normal embryogenesis. Either way, whichever camp you believe, it's important to note that nasal dermoids can have an intracranial extension, which some people think lends more credence to the cranial origin theory. Our knowledge of nasal and midface development can also provide some insight here. So during normal nasal and midface development, a portion of dura often projects through the foramen cecum and is attached to the skin. This dura will normally separate from the nasal skin and retract through the foramen cecum as development continues, and this connection essentially is obliterated. But if the skin maintains that attachment and that underlying fibrous tissue, nasal capsule, or dura, depending on the extent of obliteration or not, these elements can be pulled into that prenasal space. So it may or may not have a dural connection, but it will present as this pathology, which we call a nasal dermoid. Specifically thinking about how likely is intracranial extension, it's variable in the literature, so ranging anywhere from 5 to 45%. So we need to exclude it when we're thinking about surgical management of these patients. And finally, unlike dermoids found in other parts of the body, nasal dermoids can present as either a cyst, a sinus, or a fistula, so more similar to other branchial anomalies.
Given this variability in how nasal dermoids manifest, how can patients with nasal dermoids present, and what should we be thinking about during this initial evaluation?
Patients with nasal dermoids typically present in childhood, though there are reports of patients presenting as the first time as an adult. Oftentimes, nasal dermoids are present at birth. Well, they're always present at birth, though they may not be obvious or symptomatic until a bit older. The mean age of presentation is between a year and 3 years, so 14 to 34 months. A nasal dermoid will present as a midline nasal mass. It can be located anywhere from the base of the columella all the way up the nasal dorsum to the glabella. Most commonly, these are seen right along the nasal dorsum. Importantly, there's no correlation between the initial presentation of nasal dermoid, that is, where it's located or how it appears, with the chance of intracranial extension. Nasal dermoids often present as a non-compressible mass, pit, or cyst, and they can sometimes present as a midline nasal hair or tuft. That's what we typically see as the kind of textbook appearance. When the hair over the midline of the nose is noted, it's important to remember that the hair protruding through the cutaneous punctum over the nasal dorsum is pretty pathognomonic for a nasal dermoid. Local infection can be common. That can range from an abscess forming in that area, as well as periorbital and midfacial cellulitis. Think of it again as anomalous to your preauricular pit. It can present as a local abscess or facial cellulitis. More rarely, we can see meningitis or even an intracranial abscess. Obviously, this would require some intracranial extension of the nasal dermoid. From physical exam, in an extreme case, we can see hypertelorism, since nasal dermoids often distort the contour of the nose, resulting in nasal broadening. And nasal dermoids can range in size from just a few millimeters to actually a few centimeters, though most are between 1 to 2 centimeters in diameter. When evaluating midline nasal masses, there are a couple tests that tell us to distinguish one from the other. The first is the Furstenberg sign, and I'm personally intrigued by this because when I was a first-year medical student, this was an interesting physical exam on a patient I was seeing during a summer rotation. So a feature of these masses is that the head communicates with the intracranial compartment. And a Furstenberg sign is when an increase in intracranial pressure will result in bulging or swelling of the mass. And when we see that, we consider that a positive Furstenberg sign. This can occur when the baby is crying, or it can be induced in an older child, such as with a Valsalva, or induced by the person examining them by compressing the internal jugular vein. Nasal dermoids have a negative Furstenberg sign. No bulging or swelling of the mass is seen with an increase in intracranial pressure. Though they may have a stalk that tracks to the dura, it's often not fluid-filled or in continuity with the meninges or the CSF, so no change in size or color is seen. The second test we think about with midline nasal masses is transillumination. So this is similar to diagnostic transillumination of other parts of the body, in that if you shine a high-intensity light through the area of interest, it will or will not be able to transilluminate. And nasal dermoids do not transilluminate. Again, they have those endodermal, mesodermal elements, and they are going to be more solid. So in summary, they're going to have a negative Furstenberg sign and do not transilluminate. In terms of history gathering, it's important to understand the course of this nasal lesion leading up to the presentation. So they can be seen as a sinus opening with intermittent discharge of sebaceous material. So ask about this, along with any chronic drainage symptoms that may point you towards that diagnosis of nasal dermoid. They can present with symptoms of nasal obstruction, especially if it's not entirely extranasal. So it's important to perform bilateral nasal endoscopy, especially in young patients who are obligate nasal breathers. A submucosal septal lesion can also be seen in this endonasal extension of the dermoid, though I find that really difficult to appreciate on physical exam. It's much easier to appreciate with imaging. And as mentioned previously, the history of local infections or meningitis is paramount to this diagnosis. And they also tend to increase in size over time, just like dermoids in other parts of the body. Finally, nasal dermoids can present with other congenital anomalies, up to around 40% of cases, including craniofacial abnormalities such as craniosynostosis, nasolacrimal duct cyst, cleft lip and palate, and hemifacial microsomia. Patients have also been reported to have oral atresia, hydrocephalus, brachial sinus abnormalities, and albinism. And then rarely we have seen case reports of other reported cardiac, GI, GU, and central nervous system anomalies. So a detailed history and physical is definitely warranted in these patients, especially if you're considering surgical intervention.
Is there any inheritance pattern to nasal dermoids?
There have been some reports of familial cases or autosomal dominance inheritance in certain instances of nasal dermoids. Additionally, evidence shows that there's a slight male predominance, but there isn't one unifying inheritance pattern or implicated gene or syndrome that we think of as being more so associated with nasal dermoids than not.
And when we're working these patients up, what imaging should we consider when evaluating patients with a suspected nasal dermoid?
Okay, now we get into a little bit of the controversial material. So, of course, you want to think about your good history in your physical exam. And you're right that the next step is often imaging. So some of the findings on physical exam will be diagnostic of themselves, such as that tuft of hair from a midline nasal cutaneous punctum. However, imaging isn't important for only diagnosis, but also for planning your surgical treatment. Nasal dermoids need to be evaluated with MRI to determine if the intracranial extension is present, and if it is present, what the extent of that extension is, since that will directly influence your surgical plan. So MRI is the gold standard for imaging. On T1 weighted images, nasal dermoids will be a variable signal intensity depending on the degree of fat or protein content. On T1 weighted images, a high intensity signal near the crista galli would suggest the presence of an intracranial dermoid. On T2, nasal dermoids will appear well circumscribed and moderately hyperintense. Regarding CT, we typically think of avoiding CT in children due to the associated radiation exposure. However, when we're actually managing these kids, we often will go ahead and get that CT. And the reason is twofold. Many of us are comfortable understanding the bony anatomy of the skull base on CT. And in children, in infants, there can be variable ossification of the skull base. And CT can give us a better sense of where that ossification is, how much the skull base is developed, and can really help us with our surgical planning. In very young kids, you want to also avoid exposures to anesthesia. And there's definitely children that are not able to sit through a CT without anesthesia. And so if I have a patient who I am strongly suspected of a nasal dermoid who's going to require anesthesia to be able to image them, I will often go ahead and get the MRI and the CT during the same anesthetic. There are some studies that show that CT is comparable to MR in terms of predicting intracranial extension of the dermoid. This may be useful for patients who are unable to get an MRI or who would require sedation. And then they can appear cystic on both scans, CT or MRI. So in short, when you're thinking about your must-have, that's MRI, because you must know if there's intracranial extension, and that's the gold standard for answering that question. However, it's reasonable to consider CT in certain patient populations.
Great. Thank you for providing the context of the nuances to working up these patients. What is the natural history of these lesions, and how should they be managed by us?
So unfortunately, without intervention, these lesions will get larger and continue to be an infection risk. Definitive management for nasal dermoids is surgical excision. Regarding your surgical approach, if there is no intracranial extension, nasal dermoids can be excised via a number of external nasal approaches, the most common of which is often an open rhinoplasty, but also there are lateral rhinotomy, transverse incisions, vertical midline incisions, inverted U incisions, and a degloving approach as documented in the literature. Ultimately, the surgical approach depends upon the location and the size of the lesion. Nasal dermoids are not always entirely accessible endoscopically, so this is not an option. It is often a combined open and endoscopic procedure. The goal of the surgery is to excise the entire cyst wall, plus the fibrous stalk must be dissected out and removed. If there's intracranial extension, open craniotomy can be warranted. Again, a combined approach with our neurosurgical team colleagues. We are getting more and more advanced at being able to address some of these endoscopically, but the team taking care of the child should be prepared and able to convert to an open procedure if needed. Intracranial extension most often passes through the foramen cecum or cribriform plate, where it then goes into the base of the frontal fossa and adheres to the falx cerebri extradurally. True intracranial extension is less common, so therefore open craniotomy is less common, but recurrence or persistence will occur if that extension is incompletely resected. So again, be sure to get your pre-op imaging and have all your surgical contingency plans should you discover something that maybe looks a little bit more extensive than your imaging suggested. Complete surgical resection is paramount because an incomplete resection leaves the patient still vulnerable to potential complications, as if they didn't undergo a complete resection at all. So this includes enlargement of the lesion, facial skeleton distortion, infection, meningitis, intracranial abscess, all things that we don't want to leave on the table for our patients. Recurrence rate is low overall, but because there can be microscopic fragments of disease left that take a long time to declare, reoccurrence can occur several years after resection. So I typically follow these patients for at least 5 years with radiographic imaging.
Now that we've discussed nasal dermoids and their management, let's move on to nasal gliomas, another congenital nasal midline mass. What are nasal gliomas and how do they form?
Nasal gliomas, also called nasal glial heterotopia, is another congenital midline nasal mass. You might also hear it referred to by some other names, such as neuroglioma and brain tissue heterotopia. They're also benign, as evidenced by the name glial heterotopia, just comprised of a mass of mature glial cells that is outside a location of the central nervous system. So glial heterotopia is most commonly found in the nose and nasopharynx, hence the term nasal glioma. So depending on the location of the glial mass, the nasal glioma can be divided into three types: the in nasal type, where the mass is located in the nasal cavity, the ex nasal type, where the mass is located within the subcutaneous tissue of the nose, and then a mixed type, where the mass is present in both of these locations. In terms of etiology, essentially they result from glial tissue being pinched off or trapped during embryonic development. In other words, a faulty closure of that anterior neuropore can result in nasal gliomas. Again, the theory of how this actually happens is a bit controversial, but the most widely accepted theory includes the following. So first, there's this abnormal migration of glial cells from the olfactory bulb. And then in an early stage of embryonic development, the gap between the nasal bone and the frontal bone is not completely closed. As the developing frontal lobe enlarges, some glial cells are transferred to the subcutaneous tissue of the nasal root. This then results in that external nasal glioma. Or the glioma within the nasal cavity is thought to be the result of cranial fusion, which leads to the formation of a brain tissue hernia, essentially, into the front of the developing nose. When the frontal and nasal bones close, they separate that heterotopic tissue from the remaining brain tissue. A nasal glioma can be connected to the brain by a stalk of tissue in about 15% of cases, but that stalk doesn't contain a direct CSF filled tract communicating with the subarachnoid space. Pathology seen in nasal gliomas coincides with these theories. Histologic exam shows a predominantly glial cell composition. Importantly, this is often seen in cephaloceles, underlying the need for a careful workup when these patients present.
So, how do nasal gliomas typically present?
Extracranial glial heterotopia, or nasal gliomas, in general is in about the same incidence as a nasal dermoid, 1 in 20,000 to 1 in 40,000. Though nasal gliomas are the most common site of intracranial glial heterotopia, they are less common than nasal dermoids. Other documented sites where glial heterotopia can occur include the scalp, the orbit, the nasal cavity, the middle ear, the mastoid, the palate, the tongue root, and even in the neck, none of which are as common as nasal gliomas. In terms of where nasal gliomas are seen and how they present, they can involve the nasal cavity, the subcutaneous tissue of the nose, or both. Historically, we think of them as having an intranasal location as being the most common, though some recent studies have shown an extranasal presentation more common than we initially thought. When they are located on the nasal dorsum, they may be slightly off of midline. Both extranasal and intranasal gliomas are nodular or polyp-like in appearance. They can have a smooth, glassy surface, medium hardness, and are non-compressible. Intranasal presentations are not typically seen on one side more than the other, so right or left, but they can present on the lateral nasal wall. Nasal obstruction may be present when there is an intranasal component. In newborns or infants, it's important to consider again that these are obligate nasal breathers. Can also present with obstruction of the lasolacrimal duct with epiphora. Local infection, abscess, or meningitis can occur depending on the extent of the lesion and how much of the nasal cavity it occupies and where specifically within the nasal cavity it's located. So as children grow, so too can these nasal gliomas, which depending on the location may cause those same cosmetic differences as we saw in nasal dermoids. So widening of the nasal root and the interpupillary distance, resulting in hypertelorism. Again, a slight predominance of male to female presentation in the literature, about 3 to 2. And nasal gliomas are often diagnosed within the first few years of life. There's mixed data in terms of what kinds present first, being intranasal or extranasal. And I think of it as having an intranasal glioma may cause obstruction to prompt a diagnosis earlier in life, but obvious extranasal gliomas are going to be more easily noted on physical exam and may present therefore earlier as well. In at least one study, about 90% of reviewed cases were diagnosed within the first 3 years of life. We don't have any specific syndromes associated with this, and they don't tend to exhibit familial heredity. Nasal gliomas are often not accompanied by other congenital malformations.
How should we go about assessment of these patients along with imaging for further workup?
Sure. So here we come back to those characteristic tests that can help us identify and differentiate different nasal lesions from one another. Nasal gliomas will have a negative Furstenberg sign. They will not enlarge with crying, internal jugular compression, or Valsalva. They should be non-pulsatile. Nasal gliomas also do not transilluminate, which makes sense since they don't have a CSF component with intracranial contents. Nasal endoscopy is performed to determine exactly the side, the origin, if possible, and the extent of the nasal mass as much as you are able to. You should definitely assess for pulsatility and Furstenberg transillumination to differentiate these from encephalocele specifically. I think this is also a good time to mention that we don't biopsy these in clinic, any nasal mass really, without imaging beforehand. Uncommonly, nasal gliomas can extend into the orbit, the frontal sinus, the oral cavity, or posteriorly back into the nasopharynx. Needle aspiration or biopsies should really be avoided, and workup is via imaging by this point. Again, you don't want to aspirate or biopsy what you think is a glioma, but is actually an encephalocele and cause a CSF leak or put the patient at increased risk of infection. In terms of imaging, CT and MR, again, can be useful in assessing the scope and nature of the lesions. And similar to dermoids, really weighing that potential radiation from a CT versus the need for sedation with an MRI. If you suspect intracranial extension at all, MRI is going to be a must-have. Depending on your bony anatomy, some people will often get CT as well. Because these tend to present a little bit older than our nasal dermoids in pediatrics, I will often, again, get my CT and MR concurrently. On MRI, nasal gliomas are often iso-intense relative to the normal brain, which makes sense given that it's essentially brain where it shouldn't be. And then high-resolution MRI can also help determine if there's an intracranial extension.
And then once we've made this diagnosis, how are nasal gliomas managed?
Sure. So again, surgical management is the definitive treatment for this congenital nasal mass. Early surgical excision is recommended to avoid further enlargement of the mass and distortion of the facial skeleton or any mass effect on the surrounding structures. In contrast to nasal dermoids, endoscopic resection is often achievable for nasal gliomas. Of course, this depends on the glioma being intranasal and without intracranial extension. Extranasal gliomas can be resected in a similar adaptable approach as nasal dermoids, depending on exactly the location. And really, external rhinoplasty techniques are going to be the workhorse here. If there is an intracranial extension, craniotomy and consultation with our neurosurgery colleagues is warranted. And it's important to continue to follow up these patients after surgical resection. There have been recurrence rates as high as 10% reported for these lesions, and prompt surgical resection may be warranted if recurrence is noted, depending on exactly where in the nasal cavity it's located and if the patient is having any symptoms.
Great. Well, let's move on now to encephalocele, which we've already alluded to in the masses we've discussed so far. What is an encephalocele?
An encephalocele is usually used to refer to herniation of brain tissue and or meninges. So we're going to get a little technical here, but meningoencephalocele indicates that both brain tissue and meninges are involved in the herniation. Encephalocele would indicate the presence of brain tissue in the herniation, but without specifying the involvement of meninges. For our purposes today, encephalocele will refer to both of these circumstances. So the herniation of brain tissue occurs via some bony defect in the skull. Importantly, that herniated brain tissue then remains connected with the intracranial nervous system and the subarachnoid cavity. In terms of etiology, the exact cause of an encephalocele is not known. Generally speaking, for nasal encephaloceles, they are thought to be due to a congenital fusion abnormality at the nasal root, resulting in this neural herniation. From a histology standpoint, encephaloceles generally are composed of brain and meningeal tissue. While encephaloceles will have glial cells, similar to nasal gliomas, they also have neuronal cells and ependymal membranes, which are elements that are rarely observed in a nasal glioma.
How can encephalocele present as nasal masses, and what does the initial workup look like for these?
Encephalocele have been reported to occur in 1 out of every 4,000 live births. A nasal encephalocele, however, is less common, and this can also comprise of an occipital encephalocele seen more specifically in Dandy Walker Chiari type malformations. Occipital encephaloceles comprise about 75% of cases. Nasal encephalocele can be frontoethmoidal, basal, or both, with the most common, about 60%, being frontoethmoidal. Basal is reported to occur in about 30%, and then some combination of frontoethmoidal and basal, the remaining 10%. There's an equal distribution between males and females, and frontoethmoidal encephalocele are more common in the South, Southeast Asian populations. Herniation of the meninges or brain tissue usually enters through the upper nasal tract through the cribriform plate. Alternatively, herniation may occur via the sinus and nasopharynx through a bony defect in the sphenoid or ethmoid sinus. Frontoethmoidal encephalocele are evident at birth usually. They present as a skin-covered compressible mass at the root of the nose with or without nasal broadening. Intranasal or basal encephalocele present with a mass in the nose. It can look like a polyp or a glioma, but as we mentioned, you don't want to needle or aspirate or biopsy or really even manipulate this tissue, since you do run the risk of CSF leak, cerebral herniation, or even meningitis. Now, when we're talking about nasal encephalocele, the characteristic tests we've discussed can really help us differentiate these from other masses. These masses are compressible, and they should have a positive Furstenberg sign. So they're going to enlarge with crying, straining, or internal jugular compression. This makes sense, given how the brain tissue and the CSF contents of this mass are in continuity with the intracranial cavity. They will also transilluminate. So depending on the extent of herniation, these can present at birth or shortly afterwards due to nasal obstructive symptoms or meningitis. The most recent patient that I have with a nasal encephalocele actually had a sitter assigned to him to keep him calm so that it wouldn't continue to grow until we could go forward with definitive management. So encephalocele can also be seen and associated with other craniofacial abnormalities, especially cleft lip and palate. So they may even present as a mass in the mouth if the herniation has progressed to that level while the baby was still in utero. Also, most cases are sporadic without an obvious genetic link or family history. And in terms of workup, nasal exam and endoscopy, as we have mentioned, is very important. MR, again, going to be that standard of imaging, as this is going to provide the most detailed visualization of the skull base, the associated defect, and the intracranial connection. And then the appearance on imaging is essentially continuous with CSF and our brain tissue that's just outside of where it's supposed to be in the intracranial cavity. So it will be iso-intense to the respective tissues.
Once a diagnosis of encephalocele has been made, what does treatment look like for these patients?
Again, so surgery is going to be the definitive treatment here to prevent further complications and the greater associated risk of meningitis with this nasal mass than with either of the prior discussed masses. And that makes sense because here we have a direct connection to the intracranial space. This is done in close collaboration with our skull-based surgery or neurosurgery colleagues. Sometimes we will often involve plastic surgery as well, depending on who does a lot of the cleft palate work and if there's extensive cleft palate associated with the encephalocele. Generally speaking, dysplastic brain tissue may need to be resected, followed by dural closure, and then soft tissue closure on top of that. For intranasal limited lesions, we often try our best to perform a transnasal anterior skull base approach, as this is less morbid and quite effective. Frontal craniotomy may be warranted, though, depending on the extent and severity of herniation. In terms of surgical outcomes, usually we can say that this has a minimal neurologic effect on the patient, though this may depend on if there's brain parenchyma that's been resected and how much. The other big consideration here is that these lesions can have a pretty intense vascular supply. So being present in the room while the baby is being intubated and able to assist with airway management is very important in the care of these patients from a surgical perspective.
Great. I think that this was a really thorough review of three different midline congenital nasal masses for us to keep in mind and when we see these patients. Is there anything else you'd like to mention or make sure we cover related to this topic?
Thank you so much for having me today, Patrick. And the most important takeaway, I think, is that we see a lot of nasal obstruction in babies and just have a low threshold to get that MRI to perform a scope and try to and see the baby back again if you're on the fence, because these are kind of can't miss diagnoses. And so it's okay if you get some imaging and it's negative, but you definitely don't want to miss these. And then the second big takeaway is don't biopsy these in the clinic.
Great. Thanks so much. In summary, there are many different possibilities for midline congenital nasal masses, though nasal dermoids, gliomas, and encephaloceles are important diagnoses to consider. Nasal dermoids are epithelium-lined masses with ectodermal and mesodermal components. They present as a non-compressible mass, a pit or cyst, and can sometimes have a midline nasal hair or tuft of hair, which is pathognomonic for nasal dermoids. Definitive management is by surgical excision from a number of external nasal approaches, depending on the location and the size of the dermoid. Nasal gliomas are masses of mature glial cells found in a location outside the central nervous system, in this case, the nose. They can involve the nasal cavity, subcutaneous skin of the external nose, or both. Surgical excision is also definitive in these lesions, and an endoscopic approach can be employed in endonasal gliomas, while extranasal gliomas can be resected in adaptable approaches similar to those seen for nasal dermoids, depending on the location, including external rhinoplasty. Intracranial extension can occur in both of these lesions, warranting attention to imaging during the workup to avoid leaving behind tissue during resection. Encephaloceles are herniated brain tissues that remain connected with the intracranial nervous system and the subarachnoid cavity. Frontoethmoidal encephaloceles are evident at birth usually, presenting as a skin-covered compressible mass at the root of the nose, while basal encephaloceles are intranasal. Again, if there is any suspicion for encephalocele, you do not want to needle aspirate, biopsy, or even really manipulate this tissue, since you run into the risk of CSF leak, further cerebral herniation, or increased risk of meningitis. Surgical management is also definitive and consists of skull base reconstruction. Now onto our questions. What embryologic tissue derivatives do nasal dermoids have that differentiate them from teratomas? Nasal dermoids have ectodermal and mesodermal components, but unlike teratoma, they do not have tissue of endodermal origin. Next question. For nasal dermoids, gliomas, and encephaloceles, describe the Furstenberg test and transillumination findings for each. Nasal dermoids have a negative Furstenberg test and do not transilluminate. Nasal gliomas also have a negative Furstenberg test and do not transilluminate. And encephaloceles have a positive Furstenberg test and do transilluminate. Last question. How do imaging findings for nasal dermoids, gliomas, and encephaloceles differ from each other? For nasal dermoids, for T1-weighted images, they will be of variable signal intensity depending on the fat or protein content. However, on these T1-weighted images, a high-intensity signal near the crista galli should suggest the presence of intracranial dermoid. On T2, nasal dermoids will appear well-circumscribed and moderately hyperintense. For nasal gliomas, they are often isointense relative to the normal brain on MR, which makes sense given that this is essentially heterotopic brain tissue. High-resolution MR can also determine if there is intracranial extension. Encephaloceles, on imaging, have an appearance that is essentially continuous with CSF and or brain tissue that is herniated out of the intracranial cavity with the same associated intensities. All right, that's it for now. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time on Head Mirror's ENT in a Nutshell.